Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Please. Thank you. I certainly hope, dear, that you heard that introduction and that you took all of those high accolades to heart. I always tell my wife, who is not only the love of my life but my best friend, that I keep longing for the day when she can develop that Nancy Reagan look. Now, you guys are somewhat young, but you probably remember that when Ronald spoke, Nancy had the adaptability to just kind of look up and hang upon his every word, even though she might be wondering what he was going to say. I would have to confess that the love of my life has yet to master that, but after that introduction, it seems to me that it's only appropriate, so I will be watching, my dear. I will be watching. Good evening. It's a delight to be here. I will say that I got here under somewhat false pretense. Your president is a remarkable man, and I made his acquaintance at an event in Washington, D.C., where he had looked up the bios and came to me and said, "I see you're from Amherst," and so we had a delightful conversation, and he suggested that I should return, something I hadn't done for, I don't think I've been on this campus for 25, 26 years, and I told him that while I valued much my experience at Amherst, that perhaps in my heart of hearts I wasn't the appropriate one to do this. And so rather than to be rude and say, "No, you can't come," I said, "Well, look, maybe I'll think about it if you come to Frontier Days." And he, of course, looked at me as one might, as all of you do, and saying, "What is Frontier Days?" Well, Frontier Days is a big event in Wyoming, considered the largest outdoor rodeo competition in the North American, on the North American continent. And it's a big deal, and we go on for 10 days, and we have all the events that you would expect. And I thought, surely, this fellow who's the president of Amherst and from New York, of all places, for sure wouldn't want to come to Wyoming and join the Cowboys for Frontier Days. Well, my first lesson about your president was to be careful if you lay down the gauntlet, he may walk right across it. And he did. He showed up, and while he was a great sport, and we very much enjoyed hosting him, at the end of his visit, I had encouraged him, if he wanted to, that we could get him on a bronco, perhaps on a wild bull, or something appropriate, all of which he declined. However, he did graciously ride in a carriage and a parade and learn to do wrist, wrist, elbow, elbow, wrist, wrist, elbow, elbow, which is the proper way to wave in a parade. But on his way, on his departure, he reminded me of our original discussion, and hence I am here tonight. I'm honored to be here and have enjoyed a great time with Tony and Karen, and actually have enjoyed being on the Amherst campus. I arrived here about 39 years ago. I can remember being in this room, and I believe I was right up there. Beyond that, I can't... A little further forward, just a little further forward. Beyond that, I cannot tell you who spoke, what they said, nor is it lost in history. That we were all very attentive, but frankly, it was our first days at Amherst, and we were excited and thinking about courses and meeting new people, and we're very much enwrapped. Now, the reason I bring that up is it gives me great solace, because it means if I don't say anything that makes sense here tonight, none of you will remember anyway. So it is an easy burden for a speaker being aware of that, until I was asked if it is okay if you place this speech on the Amherst website. A little less comforting, because for fear that my children might read it. I have a daughter who I tried to persuade to come to Amherst not too many years ago. She graduated from high school in Cheyenne, which is our home, got into a number of institutions, and traveled with her mother out to do the obligatory look at colleges. And she came back and announced that, from her point of view, she was going to Princeton because Amherst was far too rural, notwithstanding that I had described to her that Amherst was a very cosmopolitan area as I remembered it. Now, why did I remember it that way? Why I remembered it that way is how I got to Amherst, which is a question that I think nearly everyone I've met since I've been here in the last 2 days has asked, how does somebody from Wyoming end up coming to Amherst College? And remember, I came here in the fall of 1969. I arrived at Amherst with my boots, my hat, and one suitcase, and I had an interesting course that brought me to Amherst, which was the superintendent of schools in the small town that I was born and raised, and all of the ranch kids that I grew up with, we all went to this school. in Thermopolis, the superintendent of schools, his daughter, had at the University of Wyoming married a gentleman who came here and was for a time on the economics faculty. So I'm walking down the hall, and it's a small community, and the superintendent's aware that if I'm going to college, as the seventh of eight kids in a family of on a ranching family with no money, I'm going on scholarships, and he throws this application at me and says, Friedenthal, as long as you're filling out applications, fill out one for Amherst College, which I did. And I was fortunate enough to get admitted here and a number of other institutions. But it was Amherst College that offered me, at that point, once you got admitted, they were need blind, and they made up a package that allowed me to come. And so sight unseen, in those days you didn't do the, or at least we didn't, do the go look at the colleges. So sight unseen, I arrived at Amherst and discovered two things. That from my perspective, it was very urban, but from my daughter's perspective, having grown up in the city, she found it to be very rural. But the other thing was that I had suddenly entered not only a different part of the country, but a different culture in the country. In that in rural Wyoming, the idea, and remember this is 69, this is the anti-war movement, this is marching in the streets, this is closing schools, this is all closing colleges, taking over the president's office, seizing control of the institutions. Not only had I left traveled thousands of miles in terms of distance, but I had left from what I considered to be a relatively stable environment where, I mean, we read about that stuff in the newspapers and were familiar with it, but thought surely people don't do that. Students don't march and take over schools and do all of that. So I showed up. Wonderful institution. And I arrived in the midst of all of this sort of cultural evolution that was going on in the country. And it's hard to envision today with the calmness. But when I arrived, most of the guys' hair was longer than the girls, and there were no women. By the way, I will say that having added women to the curriculum or to the student body curriculum, they were always in the curriculum. Having added them to the student body is a significant improvement. I was at the gathering last night, and I can tell you that the gathering, when it was all young men, was not nearly as much fun the first night as you all appeared to be having down there. But I arrived here, and it was a very interesting kind of time. And it was one of those times when not only was I questioned about making the adjustment to being at Amherst, but also questioned about sort of the adjustment to an entirely new culture. I remember my first small group meeting on our dorm. I was in Stearns. And we gathered, and we go around the room, and everybody's talking about what they did for the summer. And part of the folks had been in Paris, and somebody had been off in safari in Africa and all of that. So they get to me, and I said, well, I spent the first part of the summer pouring concrete on Interstate 80, and the second part of the summer working an oil rig. And all of a sudden, it became clear that there was some difference in life experiences from me for them. But it turns out that Amherst, over the years, has become a place for which I have great fondness. I will admit, as I did to the Dean of Students, that at the time I left, I was not sufficiently fond of it to participate in graduation. It had been a remarkable experience, but one that, and I would say this honestly, I mean, I barely made it my first year. Not only was I culturally uncomfortable with the nature of the sort of student revolution, because it was not part of my makeup, I was not entirely comfortable with the sort of vast economic gulf between myself and the majority of the students. So my first semester is not a particularly stellar transcript. I believe the phrase is academic probation. It's an ugly phrase, and one that I would encourage you to avoid. But this is a remarkable institution in that it makes the effort in a wide variety of ways to make sure that you have the opportunity to take advantage of the education. Among my regrets is that I didn't figure it out soon enough. And I would encourage all of you who sort of, obviously today's the day. I mean, you're here at Amherst and it's been a goal and it's a remarkable event. But over the next few weeks and over the next few months, you're gonna find obstacles and things that you hadn't anticipated. I would encourage you not to spend a lot of time being angry. I find that in retrospect, being angry was a waste of time. It didn't even make me feel good. And I became angry at the institution, and I became literally in a German course. I said, they can't make me take German. I'm 18, I can do what I want. And so I didn't go. So the professor calls me in, and he says, you know, Mr. Friedenthal, if you don't show up at German, I'm going to have to flunk you. And I said, really? And he said, yes. And I never did show up, and I flunked German. There's absolutely no explanation for it, no rational explanation. After all, one should be able to, having gotten relatively good scores on your college entrance exams, to be able to figure out that if you don't show up, you're likely to flunk. It's a small but logical leap that I think we can all make. And I guess the lesson of it is that ultimately we make those decisions and we need to sort through why we made them. I made them for all the wrong reasons. All the wrong reasons. But eventually you sort it out, and that's part of the wonder of the Amherst experience. Now, I need to also tell you with regard to your president that he is a man of kind heart. When I suggested that you read Franklin Winston, he not only called my office once, but called my office twice saying, which parts of the book do you want him to read? The first time it was polite, and the second time it was accompanied with the information that it was a rather long book. My response was, tell him to read the whole damn thing. It's a great book. There's a great deal in it, and they have all summer. But I want you to know that he interceded on your behalf to save you from having to read it. And so he said, well, why did you have him read it? I wanted you to read that book because I think it's a remarkable reflection of the interplay of two people and the importance of friendship and the importance of some messages that are contained in that book. And it unfortunately, we end up, all of these books end up being about grand historical figures cast against the background of the Second World War and America's tentative involvement and then its eventual full participation. But the human traits that are in that book are present in all of us. They're present in you. They're present in all kinds of things that go on every day in this country. They just don't get written up. They don't end up being a part of the historical panorama of the state. The first thing about that book, if you think about it, is that you need to be really careful about how you treat the people you meet, because sooner or later, you may meet them again. If you remember that portion, did anybody in the book, did any of you read it? How much do I need to go through? Come on now. Well, part of you are honest, part of you are fudging kind of a little bit. Anyway, there's this great part of the book. I will give you guys credit. Unlike my attitudes towards my German class, you at least showed up. That needs me to give you another lesson, which is you need to show up and probably have read the book. But there's a great thing in there in the book where Winston and Franklin actually encounter each other very early in their lives. And they form a less than positive opinion about each other. And it is an opinion that did not change until they became actively engaged with each other during the war. The other thing that's interesting about the book is that neither one of these guys were particularly well liked. If you remember, Winston's contemporaries viewed him as being boisterous, pushy, and a bit too ambitious. And there was a wonderful description of Franklin Roosevelt as somebody not all that well liked, but he was a wonderful kid, and you would invite him to dinner, but never to the dance. You would invite him to dinner, but never to the dance. So he was somebody who they sort of tolerated, and in fact, some of the language at the time was less than positive about both of them. Both of these people ended up being outcasts to some degree with their own class. They were people born of great privilege, then through their political life, became at odds with the privileged class of both of their societies. And with Franklin Roosevelt, there were whole masses of people in America who referred to him as that man in the White House, that man in the White House. And they didn't mean it as a compliment. They meant it as a terrible derogation that he had abandoned. So what does that lead you to? First, it seems to me that we all have to understand that in life, you're going to do some things that may not necessarily endear you to everyone around you. But each of those two gentlemen followed their own rudder, their own sort of sense about what they should be and where they should go. And they ultimately prevailed in terms of what they wanted to get done. the question about the dislike from their peers, essentially from the class from which they had came, has to do with the fact that we all change over time. I can go from disliking Amherst and wondering why I was even there to the second year I was at Amherst. I kind of liked Amherst and wondered why all these other students were here. Actually, I feel the same way about being governor. The first year I was elected, I went to the governor's conference and I wondered, what am I doing here? By the second year, I went there and looked around and said, what the hell are some of these people doing here? The point being that over time, you're going to evolve into a different human being than you are today. And you're going to evolve into somebody who will eventually, at some point, find themselves at odds with people that they have known for years. And you simply have to accept that, I think, as part of life. The other thing is that these two guys, I thought, were remarkable demonstrations of two people who were incredibly comfortable with who they were. Now, I didn't mean they didn't have insecurities and that, Winston wasn't always in need of approval. And, of course, Franklin Roosevelt was always manipulating and playing some kind of games. But ultimately, the two of them became comfortable with who they are and with their limitations. Why is that important? I think for me, in retrospect, had I learned at an earlier age, particularly at Amherst, to become comfortable in my own skin, that is, comfortable with who I was, I would have been able to have taken greater advantage of all that lies before you in the next 4 years. It is a remarkable experience at Amherst. There are experiences, and there are people who come onto campus, and there are places that you can go, and there are students who come from entirely different backgrounds in entirely different countries. But in order to actually take advantage of that experience, you've got to learn to be comfortable with who you are. And if you're comfortable with who you are, then the next person you meet or the next experience you have is enriching as opposed to disquieting. Because ultimately you look at it and you say, well, that is really interesting. Because people see things differently than you do. And you will be enriched by every opportunity you take to meet with them. The other thing that's great about these guys was that they had a remarkable sense of humor. They found the capacity in the darkest of hours during the war, during the darkest of times in their lives, to find time for humor. There are lots of recollections in that book of notes sent back and forth between Roosevelt and Franklin, or between Franklin and Winston, in which they actually sort of had their set of inside jokes, their ability to find humor in what it is that goes on around them. And I would encourage you to keep your sense of humor. I mean, life is amazingly funny if you can just step back, not in a kind of mean fashion, not in a Saturday Night Live fashion, but in a kind of amusing fashion. And I'd illustrate it this way. For 7.5 years, I was a prosecutor, and it was my job to put people in jail, and I did it. And I was glad to do it, and I did it with relish, and I felt morally justified and was delighted to do it. The humor in life is that after I became governor, it became my job to grant pardons and commute sentences. And I had occasion for somebody who I had put in jail to send in and ask for a pardon or commutation. I never thought I would do it. Never thought that having spent that time. So how did I sort of struggle with it? Eventually, I just became humorous, or sort of, I developed a sense of humor about the irony of life, that I would go from being a prosecutor to being the one person in the state as governor who has the power of clemency, the power to modify a sentence, the power to pardon somebody. And by being able to see the sort of humor and the irony in it, I was able to take that transition and to play both of those roles. And it's a very interesting thing that as you go through life, there's much to be enjoyed, and to be enjoyed in the very humorous vein. I would also think that the other nice thing about this book is that it dovetails quite nicely with the smaller text. Now, did you all read the one about, I can't remember what the title of it was. What was the title of that one? Soul of a Citizen. How many of you read that? It was shorter. It was a lot shorter. I mean, you could have read it last night. The marvelous part about that, The Soul of a Citizen, living with conviction in a cynical time, is that it comes at exactly the same questions from the other side. It comes from the point of view that history is actually shaped by ordinary people, sometimes doing extraordinary things, but oftentimes doing just ordinary things. The discussion about Rosa Parks is particularly telling in that the history that I read, and I suspect the history that you read throughout your high school years, focuses on her actions as sort of this singular event, almost as though Joan of Arc had risen up in the Deep South and had suddenly taken a stand. But the true history is that it was a series of steps over 10 and 12 years that finally brought her to the point where she drew the line and said, it's time to move forward and it's time that we're not going to put up with this anymore. And the point of that is that each of you are going to, at some point, depart from Amherst and regain a normal life, a life in which you're going to say, well, I can't do that. I mean, I'm not Rosa Parks, I'm not Martin Luther King, I'm not Ronald Reagan, I'm not any of these folks, and you're going to want to say, well, I can't do it. The other message of that article for me was that business about if you wait for the perfect standard, if you wait for everything to be just right until the stars align and you feel like you can, you know, lift the world, you'll never do it. I illustrate it in a personal sense. When we decided to run for governor, it was our first attempt at public office. I'd never run before, had been around politics, had worked with people in politics, but had never run for office before. Had we said, no, we got to wait till we have enough money, we have to wait till Wyoming suddenly becomes a Democratic state, bearing in mind now that Wyoming is by registration, two-thirds Republican, and we were running as a Democrat. If you said all of those things till I had just the perfect opportunity, we never would have run. We chose to run because we had something to say. I didn't like the way the state was being led and wanted to take a crack at changing that. And had we waited until everything was perfect, we wouldn't have done anything. And I can't tell you how important that message is. We have a son who is getting his PhD in biochemistry. And one of our predicaments with him as he was growing up was unless he felt like he was already good at something, he didn't want to try it. He didn't want to try out for football because he wasn't sure he was as good as some of the other kids. But he finally tried out, turned out to be a great football player. But that moment when he looked around and said, well, I'm not sure I'll be the best. I'm not sure I'll be perfect at it. I'm not sure that everything is just the way it should be, gave him a tentativeness that kept him from reaching out. Now, I will say that now that he's in his mid-20s and has graduated, he is completely reverted. He's completely obnoxious. There's nothing that he thinks he can't do. He's far smarter than I am. But I guess my point to you is don't be afraid to try. Don't be afraid to fail. And remember Einstein's admonition that those who claim they haven't made a mistake have never done anything in their life. Lots of people have used the same phrase. But be kind to yourself. You're going to try some things. You're going to make some mistakes. But go ahead. A mistake never killed anybody. A mistake is the kind of thing that, as a person, you can grow from. Take those mistakes. Take advantage of them and see what happens. You're going to make mistakes. But be kind to yourself when you do. Doesn't mean that you get to ignore them. When I say be kind to yourself, make sure that you learn something from them. My last thing, and then I want to take some questions, is to talk a little bit about why it is that I, as governor of Wyoming, end up in a really interesting position to tell you a little bit about our state. Our state's one of those places, and I know that you're all familiar with the global warming discussion. Our state is one of those places that produces about 14% of all the energy consumed in the United States. The bulk of it, we were kind of out there, nobody paid attention, but we produce about 14% of the energy consumed. If you remove oil imports, it comes closer to 16 or 17% of the energy consumed in the United States begins in Wyoming, in this state of 523,000 people. We are the leading producer of coal. We're the second leading producer of natural gas. We're either first or second in uranium, depending on the year. We're the seventh largest producer of oil. We're probably fifth or sixth in terms of wind generation. And all of a sudden, we have gone from just a state that kind of goes along to a state that's at the center of all of this debate about global warming. And the reason that's important to me is that it reflects on the education I got here. I got an economics degree. An economics degree, and obviously economics has evolved into some different theories, but what economics taught me was a particular way of thinking. And if you can, while you're at Amherst, learn ways of thinking, of processing information, it'll be the most astounding gift that you can possess. This whole business about an Amherst education is truly a gift. But the gift that it gives you most of is the capacity to think, the capacity to reason, the capacity to think about problems. The theories that are applied in economics today are largely modifications, or at least different, than the ones that were applied when I was here. But the way of thinking about a problem is fairly remarkable. So even though all of you won't graduate at the top of the class, but remember, there has to be a place for people like me. Somebody's got to be at the bottom. I eventually graduated with honors, but I nearly flunked out. And in those days, they would let you flunk out. They would let you go. What they did is they came to your room and they talked to you about, wouldn't you be more comfortable at another institution? Which is sort of a polite way of saying your bags are packed and you're ready to go. What I would encourage you to do is to think about this experience you're going to have. It is just remarkable. Take advantage of it. Some of the things I made, some of the things I did were mistakes. Some of the things I did were fairly useful. I got a remarkable education. And my only concern in retrospect is that I didn't take full advantage of it because I didn't wrestle enough with what was going on inside of me versus what was going on outside of me. And it's tough to do because this is an incredibly competitive place. Every one of you is looking around thinking, I can beat them or I can do better. It's an incredibly competitive place, but it's also a very warm place. You develop friendships, which is the other thing that's important about this book. Franklin and Winston were both incredibly competitive personalities, but they developed a remarkable friendship which supported both of them through very troubling times. I think the most interesting contrast in the book is that Franklin Roosevelt died in office, and he passed on before he was able to actually have a conversation with Winston Churchill when Winston Churchill was summarily dispatched. I mean, he won the war. And so the English people say, well, you won the war, times are good, you're out of here. They didn't have any sense. I think it would have been fascinating to have seen a dialogue between those two people at the point in time in which Franklin would have still been in office, but of ill health, and knowing that he was on his way out, and Winston Churchill, who was summarily dispatched by a citizenry who he had led through the most trying time of English history. I think it would have been absolutely fascinating. Last thing to remember, and then I'll take questions, is that those two gentlemen ended up on exactly the same premise in the last speeches that they wrote. For the two of you or three of you who got to the final pages, there is a remarkable comparator where they talk about the speech that Franklin Roosevelt was writing when he passed on, and the final speech that Winston Churchill gave in the House of Commons. Winston Churchill, of course, had much more flair to his language, and therefore, I think, more memorable. But Franklin Roosevelt was more timid and calculating in his language, and therefore not quite as memorable. But Winston Churchill, in trying to talk to his citizens about what they needed to do going forward after the war, talked about never flinch, never weary, never despair. Franklin Roosevelt returned to his early phrases and said, the only limitation to our realization of tomorrow will be our doubts about today. And so to each of you who are fortunate enough to be at Amherst, it's a remarkable gift. I would tell you that the only limitation on your future and what you can do tomorrow will be the doubts you have about yourself today. Thank you very much, and I'll take questions. You got to ask questions so I can say all of the things that the dean and the president told me I couldn't say. Yes. Interesting. Ones that I can repeat on the record, or ones that aren't. I would say some of the most astonishing things at Amherst were Henry Seal Cominger was a professor and a lecturer here, who was this incredibly renowned scholar with regard to both history and law, and he could absolutely mesmerize. And he was not I didn't actually take a course from him. His best times were when they would have I don't know if they still do them, but they used to have faculty who would give essentially an all-campus lecture and anybody could go. They were just absolutely amazing. And I think it's part of the reason why I fell in love with the law even more than I had. And remember that when I came here, I'd already decided in fifth grade that what I was going to be was a lawyer. And the only thing that mattered to me about my undergraduate degree was to get it so I could go to law school. But Henry Steele Cominger was just remarkable. I would think the... Now, and I can say this now because they did ask, Mr. President. The other thing is that I spent a lot of my time washing pots in Valentine Hall. Part of the way that I worked my way through here was you had this work-study thing where you had to work so many hours, and so I would end up, and the morning shift was always available. And it was just really interesting to have a conversation with the people who worked for the college, as opposed to the people who were either faculty or students, you know, sort of the phrase then as they called them, townies. And it was, I don't know whether it was most memorable, I just did it so often. But great school, though. Okay. Do you want me to give you a lecture about how great I am? I've got that one. Any other questions? Hearing none? Oh, okay. In retrospect, I would encourage you to be more focused on the liberal arts aspect of it. Take the necessary courses you need to prepare yourself for the advanced stage. But the what happens is you get through here, and then all of a sudden your life just picks up a speed. You end up in law school, and you end up with a job, and you end up with a family, and pretty soon you don't have the time to sort of kind of do the survey of other learning and the survey of the arts and things. I think it's one of the reasons I enjoyed the last 2 days is that I didn't have any appointments. My life was one where I could actually sit down and read and converse. And I don't think that particularly at the age you're at, you don't appreciate what that luxury is. So I would encourage you to take full advantage of the liberal arts exposure. Take the courses that are necessary to support whatever advanced education you think you're going to have. But this may be, in a really practical sense, may be the last time you get to play with ideas that are outside your field of final study or your field of how you make your living. This is the chance to talk with people who see the world differently. It's the chance to actually study art, or you know, or things that are outside the scope. Because what happens is, the older you get, and we found this to be particularly true Nancy's a lawyer, I'm a lawyer. The busier we got in our practices, and the busier we got with our family, and the busier we got, the more of those things just sort of fell off. Now that our kids are gone, they're all out of the house. We have one left in college. We now have time to go back and to read things just because you want to read them. But I would take advantage of the opportunity here, and I don't know whether they still do it. When I was here, they had distribution requirements where you had to take, you don't do that anymore? You know, I got to tell you, you guys got it easy. You got a lot better dorms. This student center thing, I got to tell you, when I was here, let me tell you how bad it was. It was awful. I don't want to sound too much like my father, so I won't do that, but I think that for most of us who were here in the 60s and the early 70s, you guys got it pretty good. Anybody else? Yes.
Who is your least favorite governor?
Out of the sitting governors?
We're done here.
Out of the sitting governors?
I
think a politic answer to that would be that they are all remarkable people, people of outstanding virtue and intellect. I mean, I ain't real bright, but even I can see that question. Yeah.
As an Amos alumnus, and
alumni. All I know is that I come out here and he's shaking me down for money.
Uh,
I believe that you get an incredible gift here, and I believe those sort of scriptural admonitions about those to whom much is given, much is expected. I think you've got both a moral and a personal obligation to give a great deal of your energy back. This world is in real trouble, not just this country, but this world is in real trouble, and it is going to need all of the help it can get. And if you take this remarkable gift you've gotten, add it to your skills, I think that we all have an obligation to give back. I mean, as a practical matter, I've never made less money than I make being governor, but I've never felt like I am doing more to make the place where I live a better place than I do doing this. And I think you've got an obligation to give back, because you can look at the way the world is structured. It truly needs bright, energetic people who will devote themselves to figuring out problems of incredible complexity, whether it's sort of the how you develop economies around the world, or how you deal with global warming, or how you deal with health care. These are incredibly complicated, and frankly, our generation hasn't solved them. We've tried, but we keep hope alive by believing that you guys will be able to do it. Do you have a question? Right. Well, I think he's right. I mean, I think at the end of the day, if anything you do in anticipation. You were close on the quote. Don't let him give you a hard time. It was pretty, very close. It's like everything in life. If you can end up being comfortable that you did the right thing, that you did the best you could, that's probably all you're going to get. Because, for instance, I have this great thing. I was being introduced by somebody the other day at an event in Jackson Hole, and he says, well, do you know who the governor was 50 years ago? And, of course, everybody says no, and rightly so. The point is, you couldn't tell me, maybe some of you who memorized the list, like, or remember memorizing in fourth grade like we had to, could tell me who the president of the United States was 50 years ago. It was Harry Truman, but the point being that if you're doing it because of legacy or something like that, you're probably doing it for the wrong reasons, probably not doing it right. I mean, Winston Churchill did not stand and look across the channel at the Nazis because he wanted to be remembered in history. He did it because he wanted England and democracy to survive. Now, it would have been nice, which is really all I was saying, it would have been nice if somebody would have been at least a little bit gracious. But you saved Western civilization, but we're giving you the boot. But remember that it's not just these, and that's part of my point about these books. They're all written about these historical figures, and somehow we think they're incredibly unique. They had all of the foibles that we all have, and they overcame them. But they're no different than there's a lady in our church who every day, every Sunday, goes in, takes care of a lot of stuff, and just by her example, shames the rest of us into trying to be better people. And her contribution in her sphere is everybody as important as Franklin's or Winston's contribution. They were just in a larger sphere. Yeah? Uh-huh. I think we did it, and I'm never quite sure. I mean, I know we won. I got more votes than the other guy. I think what we tried to do was to figure out what's in the best interest. I mean, ours is an energy state. It's very dominated by the energy industry. But those of us who live there know that the energy industry can give us a good economy, but they're pretty hard on the environment. They're pretty hard on some other things, so in terms of education and that. So what we looked for were issues that actually people worry about at their kitchen table, health insurance, education, drugs and their kids and those things, and just talk to them as opposed to talking to either party. There are a substantial number of people in this country who are entirely sick of politics, and with good reason, because it doesn't speak to us. It speaks to the extremes. And so we essentially went out, talked to people about what we thought mattered to them, told them what we wanted to do. Even people who didn't necessarily agree with what I had in mind would support us because they'd say, well, at least you're telling us what you're going to do. And I think there's a degree of candor that helped us, I think. Plus, truth is, they like my wife, and they really like my daughter. Okay, anybody else? Oh, yes. We do. Ours is largely an extractive resource-dependent state. The mineral development is the most significant resource, then tourism behind that, both of which are incredibly resource dependent. So what we've done in our state is we've set aside, during my watch, we take about 40% of every tax severance tax dollar that we get, and we put it in something called the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund, which is essentially it's a sovereign trust fund protected by the Constitution. So that the corpus of it can't be used. You can use the interest income, but that's all you can use. We set aside another $500-600 million by constitution to support a scholarship program. One of the things we inaugurated was that every student in our state who can graduate from high school with a C, they get some assistance. If you graduate with a B or higher and an A, you get more money the higher your grades and the better your board score. What we tried to do is to set aside components so that we can sort of take care of the basics. The other thing is that right now we're really concentrating on this wind energy business. Ours is a state, if you look at those maps of wind energy in the United States, in fact on the North American continent, some of the richest zones are in Wyoming. And if we can tap those, then that becomes a continuing resource. So it is, to some degree we have to be careful because we're a commodity economy. And commodity economies, frankly, are on the downhill slide in the long run. You've got to kind of restructure how you go at it. But you have to do it in the context of kind of the reality that we're in. Yes? You know, there's a great segment in the book where it's called... I'm going to take you guys back to it every chance I get. There's a great segment in there called Those Are My Sentiments Exactly, in which there's a wonderful description of democracy, and I would recommend it to you. But for me, democracy is not necessarily the most perfect system of government. It's that old adage about it's probably better than the other alternatives. The problem is you have to have both political democracy and some form of economic democracy. You have to have some opportunity for people not only to participate in the political life, but to participate in the economic life. And I think America's done a pretty good job at that, but more recently, we're not nearly as democratic in the economic sense. Wealth is much more aggregated towards the top. I think that democracy for most of us, at least for somebody like me, is it's a fairly remarkable culture where you can essentially grow up on a ranch with, in my own particular life pattern, grow up on a ranch with no... as they say in law, no visible means of support. Find a scholarship, go to an institution like this, survive, and ultimately be able to pick the career of my choice, be able to have the opportunity for economic advancement, and then just go participate in the system. I mean, even if I had lost, being able to participate in the system on an equal footing with anybody else is such a phenomenal gift that I think it's essential to democracy. I mean, at the end of the day, the big money guys could put in a lot of money against us, and they did. We got outspent 5-1. But at the end of the day, the average citizen, his vote was worth every bit as much as the rich guy who funded my opponent, and they're the ones who put us in. Okay. Yes? I think that relationships can be based on necessity, but not friendship. I think that they would have had to have had a relationship no matter what, but they had a friendship, which I think over time, I mean, when you figure they were spending Christmas together, they were spending holidays together, and they had all of the interaction that friends have. You know, it sort of warms and it cools and they go back and forth. They would have had to have had a relationship. There was a strategic value in having that relationship for both of them. Roosevelt knew that we were going to be into the war. Obviously, Churchill wanted to get us in early. So I think that relationship would have occurred of necessity. I think the friendship, which enriched the relationship, occurred because of the nature of the two people. So I think you're absolutely right. There are, Machiavelli talks about relationships in terms of, sometimes you just have to have them. But that's different than you have to have friendships. And I think that it was not a feigned friendship between the two of them. I really think that they had their ups and downs, just like friends do. But I think at the end of the day, they were actually friends. Okay. Yes. Part of it is the nature of the West, the nature of when it comes to national offices, the West, particularly Wyoming, can be very partisan. You know, vote Republican or your mother will die. When it comes to state offices, which are much more intimate, much more retail, they begin to differentiate based on what they know about you. I think that both George Washington was right. I mean, his admonition about political parties and the dangers that they presented, he's being proven as an absolute prophet, given the way things are sorting out. I mean, all of the things that we teach in civics, that we teach people about getting along, about compromise and pragmatism and all of those have all become nasty words in American politics. Yet those are if you think about the American Constitution, this country wouldn't exist if there had not been the remarkable capacity for these people to compromise, whether it was about state representation, whether it was about slavery, whether it was about sort of the question of taxes. If the people who created this country had been as unable to reach compromise as the idiots who now frequent the United States Senate, this country would not exist. Because it simply wouldn't. And I think that two things have contributed to it. One is 24-hour news, with everybody having an opinion about everything. So we're just hit with so much information. And I think the second thing is there's just too much money in politics. There is too much money that can prop people up who, frankly, you wouldn't have them in your house for dinner, and they end up as elected officials. And that's because, they just do. So, I mean, one of the hopes that I see in particularly in your generation are people who understand that politics is not the end-all and be-all. And I hope that, you can resurrect what was a better time in this country. Okay, you've worn me out. Thank you very much. Did you have a question?